Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's an old story, a very old story, 2,000 years old, and yet it still makes the news every single year. How well it's covered is another question. It's got to be difficult if you are a journalist and you have been tasked with writing that perennial Easter story. What's your angle? What are you going to say that hasn't been said 1,000 times before? Where do you find the news in that very old news? Joining us to talk about media coverage of the resurrection, Terry Mattingly. He's a regular guest, senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
You have perused the media coverage of the, well, it's the Christian belief in the resurrection, the doctrine of the resurrection. And for you, what's the big takeaway from this year's media coverage?
Well, first of all, two things. First of all, didn't you mean 1 Corinthians in that earlier reference? I mean,
force of habit.
You got to do what you got to do to get media attention. Well, you can say you peruse coverage of the resurrection, but year after year, that falls into some extremely predictable little niches. I think you're familiar with the fact that about a week before Easter is the traditional time to run the What's Wrong with Christianity features, which may or may not have anything to do with the resurrection in any particular year. It just seems like a good time to run them, kind of like running the Why the Virgin Birth is Wrong things right before Christmas. It's just the way some people think. You need a religion story. You can't imagine a religion story being something other than controversy. So you try to create controversy, whether it's God is dead, covers, or whatever. So you have that. The second thing you have is you can always count on the Pope. I mean, the Pope is going to stand up at very predictable times during Holy Week and Easter and say things. And while major news organizations have lost many, many of their bureaus around the world, pretty much everybody has somebody in Rome, so you can get the prepared text of whatever the Pope said, and you can say, in his Easter sermon, the Pope said, global warming is the worst thing to ever happen in the world. We need peace in the Middle East. In other words, you look through the sermon and you find something where he talks about a subject that in your newsroom is considered real, and that becomes the lead for the Easter story the next day, and you've got art of the Pope and lots of flowers, and then maybe you have a local just piece of feature art, and you've survived another Easter to live another day as a newspaper. That's kind of a cynical but predictable look at the patterns. Now, what caught my eye this year, two things happened that kind of were unrelated, but then in my brain it suddenly hit me that in an interesting way they were connected. Number one was BBC did a poll where they did something that the mainstream journalists rarely do. They asked a doctrinal question as if they expected the answer to matter, and looking for an Easter story on Palm Sunday, they came out with the results of a poll, which, you know, proceeded to get quite a bit of attention in the kind of charged up atmosphere that is the British press, especially when you put a headline on it that says resurrection did not happen, comma, say quarter of Christians. Now, first of all, the fact that 25% of Christians in a highly liberal country no longer believe in the resurrection that intrigues me, but it doesn't horribly surprise me. But sure enough, they got down in deeper and dug around a little bit. And if you consider that what happens in Europe is supposed to happen in America a decade or two later, I thought this was a rare example of a news organization realizing that sometimes what people believe on matters of essential doctrine are actually important, especially in England in a post-Brexit world. If you're asking, what is England anyway? I mean, who are we as a people and a culture? Well, then the other thing that got my attention was the Pope gave one of his addresses pretty much straight up, but in the other, he did something that Pope Francis is wont to do every now and again. According to the press reports, he just took his prepared text and set it completely aside and improvised his entire Easter sermon.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of the resurrection on this Thursday, April the 20th. We'll find out what the Pope actually did say in his improvised sermon and how it got covered in the media. That's an interesting... What he says and what and how it gets covered are often two very different things. Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's also founder and editor of Get Religion. More with him on the other side of the break. Then our series, Christ in the Old Testament. We're going to be looking at the Old Testament prophet Hosea. Last time we were with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer in this series, we looked at Hosea 1 and 2 and 3, I believe. He wants to continue in that Old Testament prophet, doing 4, 5, and 6, finding Christ there. We'll do so in hour 2 of Issues, etc. Stay tuned.
Putting Christ back into Christian radio, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
Repentance and forgiveness, sin and grace, law and gospel, more than cliches, real preaching for real people in need of hearing the real Christ. Christ for you and the divine service at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, where we gather every Saturday night at 6 and on the Lord's Day, Sunday mornings at 7:45 and 10. Look for the Church of the Neon Cross on I-55 between exits 30 and 33. Find us on the web, stpaullutheranchurchhamel.org. St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, where there is the forgiveness of sins, life and salvation for the people of God.
Would you like to learn about the Reformation theology you hear on Issues, etc.? We'll send you a pamphlet of Luther's Small Catechism for free. It contains the biblical teachings on the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and confession and absolution. Order your free copy of Luther's Small Catechism today. Just send your name and mailing address to talkback@issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. We're talking with Terry Mattingly of Get Religion about media coverage of the resurrection. A little bit later, Christ in the Old Testament with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer, Hosea chapters 4, 5, and 6. Terry, before the break, you were talking about Pope Francis during his Easter address. He broke with tradition. You said he laid aside or set aside his prepared sermon. What did he do with it instead?
He focused it on a conversation with a young man who was in, as he put it, in a battle with a deadly illness. And this man was asking, as you would imagine, some very life and death questions, some of them about God. And if I can read how the Pope responded, this is how it comes out of a translation machine from Italian with a little bit of cleaning up. Today, the church continues to say, Jesus has risen from the dead. Now, here's the phrase that got to me. This is not a fantasy. It's not a celebration with many flowers. Now, of course, the Pope is standing up there on a podium surrounded by flowers in all directions. So I imagine him at that point turning and kind of pointing at all the flowers. It is the mystery of the rejected stone that ends up being the cornerstone of our existence. Christ has risen from the dead. In this throwaway culture, where that which is not useful is discarded, and I've done a little bit of editing here, that stone, Jesus, is discarded, yet is the source of life. So, in other words, the Pope got up and didn't assume that everybody listening believed in the resurrection. He actually was going to start off with this unusual statement, which is a soundbite worthy of a headline, if I've seen one lately. Easter, the resurrection, is not a fantasy. And there were other interesting things in that sermon. And sure enough, what did the press go with for most of their coverage? I saw one or two headlines, primarily the excellent Catholic news website called Crux. Sure enough, most of the headlines about the Easter sermons out of Rome all said things like, global warming is a great threat to the world. There's a lot of problems in the Middle East, that sort of thing, which was predictable Easter coverage out of a very unpredictable Easter sermon from the Pope. So mulling over what to write about here during Bright Week, those two things connected in my mind, and I wrote a column that essentially argued whether or not people believe in the resurrection is actually an interesting question to ask, and something that the press ought to ask more questions like that, quite frankly.
I mean, really, it is quite, if you think about it in the broad sweep, it is quite newsworthy, at least within the scope of the BBC's polling there, that one quarter of the Christians polled do not believe that very thing that the Apostle Paul says is the sine qua non of the Christian faith.
Yeah, and that gets us right into an issue that we talk about at Get Religion frequently, which is when you say the Catholic vote, who are the Catholics? What does Catholic vote mean? Well, in this case, if you look at modern England and you say this is what Christians think, I would argue that you immediately then have to stop and say, well, what do we mean when we use the word Christian? This time around, BBC was using the term to say self-identified Christians. In other words, people who call themselves Christians, which is something like people in Texas who call themselves Baptists, I guess, or people in Utah who call themselves Mormons. I mean, people in New York City who call themselves Jewish. You get this idea that there's this cultural use of the term, and then there's a content-laden way of using that term. So to their credit, the BBC had put some additional factors into their survey, and one of them was, how often do you go to church? And thus you ended up with the ability to make a differentiation between people who are attempting to practice the faith of Christianity versus those who are self-identifying as Christian but not doing anything about it. Still, it kind of gets your eyebrows up when you look and see a survey in which, of all the participants interviewed, half of those interviewed in modern Britain said they didn't believe in the resurrection at all. Now, if you're looking for an American frame of reference on that, you can back up 2 years or so to a Lifeway study, and of the people surveyed here in America, 45% of those strongly embraced the resurrection, and 23% agreed with it somewhat, which gets you kind of a vague pro-resurrection stance of about 70, as opposed to about 50 or so in England. Still very interesting stuff.
If I were writing, speaking for myself, the theological headline here, on the BBC numbers, it might be, and this is a bit facetious, it might be 50% of self-identified Christians aren't.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's close to that when you end up looking at the numbers. In fact, it might be a little bit more than that. There is an Anglican thinker who has a number of connections. He's a full-time writer now, but he's part-time at the University of Nottingham and serves in a local parish. His name is the Reverend Dr. Ian Paul, and he wrote a really interesting piece, which my friend and colleague George Conger pointed me toward, which added a lot of very interesting detail. In addition to having a degree in theology, his undergraduate, all the way back then, he was a mathematician when he first got out of university, and he went down into the fine details of this survey and came up with the fact that there were apparently 301 active Christians in this survey, and the active Christians believed in the resurrection 93%. And then there were 433 non-active Christians. Note that that's a larger survey than the active Christians, which may say something about England today, statistically. And of the non-active Christians, meaning people who rarely go to church, the active Christians were those who went every week or at least three times a month. The non-active Christians, 62% believed in the resurrection. And then of the 496 who said they weren't Christian at all, only 14% did. Kind of funny, I didn't have room to get it in the column as I was cutting it down to the length demanded by my format. I did find it slightly amazing that the a public relations person speaking for the Church of England referred to this survey as very good news about the state of religion in England, saying it shows people are at least thinking about these things. I'm not sure good news is the phrase I would attach to all of the details, especially not with a capital G and a capital N. When you dig down into this further, Paul, the sort of guy that it kind of intriguing, you know, a mathematician who's also a theologian, he made the obvious statement that non-active Christians don't believe the same thing as active Christians. And then he looked at question after question related to Easter and also just to belief in life after death, which the BBC poll was sharp enough to attach that issue to belief in Easter, that whether or not you believe in the resurrection might have something to do with whether you believe in any meaningful definition of life after death. And at the end of all that, Paul just concluded, and this is where I ended my column, with a statement, inactive Christians look far more like the non-Christians than the active Christians. And I thought to myself, isn't that a statement that has echoes in so many stories that we see today in all aspects of American politics and culture? I mean, how many times do you see stories that the minute you differentiate between the active participants in a faith and those that barely participate in it at all, you immediately see this night and day contrast? But if the press doesn't push that point and push it further and get down into the details of that and ask detailed questions about religious practice and observance, then does this information you're using have any meaning at all? I had this conversation for years with the late George Gallup, and he was obsessed with this issue where you ask America general religious questions, and America looks like this very religious culture. But he, and when your last name is Gallup, you're in a position to do this, he insisted that the polls ask a certain number of highly specific questions about the practice of the faith and whether the faith impacted any particular issues in day-to-day life. And he found that there were two completely different choirs of people out there, and that the self-identified Christians versus the practicing Christians were two completely different things in American life. I just wish we could get that across to journalists, that whether you're – and the same thing I'm sure is true within Islam here in America. I'm sure the same thing – I know the same thing is true in Judaism because I've actually read some of the sociology on that. And you know, how many times have you heard the statement that culture is upstream of politics?
Heard it last week.
Well, I hear it all the time, and it's very true. What I've started thinking lately, though, if culture is upstream of politics, what is upstream of culture? And what I'm wondering is that if reporters asked more questions about religious beliefs and religious practices, they might know more about what's happening to America at the level of religious faith, which then does or doesn't influence culture, or it influences culture in what believers would consider a negative way. But the other factor that's so important there, and if you read Get Religion daily, you know we're obsessed with this, at some point doctrine and demographics begin to affect each other too. And how churches treat marriage and family and the number of children that their families have and the degree to which those stay in the faith or lose the faith or fling the faith, there's a direct connection there between whether or not those religious groups continue to thrive and grow. And that's a way of affecting culture. At the same time, religious groups that decline, that's a way of influencing culture. All of this is linked to simply asking more questions about religious beliefs and how people live them out.
Would you say that what you were talking about before with Gallup, would you say that that failure to distinguish between people who are active and inactive, for lack of a better way of saying it, is, if not the main reason, one of the main reasons that the press doesn't get religion?
It certainly is one of the ones that shapes their attempts to get religion and shapes it in a bad way. Now, we talk a lot about the quest for the mythical Catholic voter, which is so important in American swing national elections because of their impact in the Midwest. And we saw that again in the most recent presidential election. But I would argue that this year, for the first time, all of American politics was incredibly influenced by the press's failure to differentiate between active evangelical Protestants and kind of culturized evangelical Protestants. And this was a part of the Trump phenomena with the press headlines day after day after day saying evangelicals love Trump. And we saw that so early on, and hardly anybody was doing what World Magazine in particular was doing, which was actually interviewing leading evangelicals and finding out what they were hearing in their own congregations. And what you found early in the primaries was that there was a very strong differentiation between kind of old guard religious right and inactive evangelicals who were pro-Trump and a lot of highly troubled people in the pews and pulpits at the level of intensely practicing evangelical Protestants in some of America's most important churches and institutions. Now, later on, of course, this turned into one of the big stories of Election Day, which was that Trump got record numbers of white evangelical votes. But once again, the polls going into that Election Day showed that about half of those people didn't want to vote for Trump. Well, once again, how was that related to whether you were a practicing evangelical Protestant or not? And the simple question is, we don't know. And that strikes me as a rather important thing to find out. If we're going to claim that Trump has some massive political debt to evangelical Protestantism, if that's the case, who does he have the debt to, and how do you deliver it when those people may not believe much of the same things at all when it comes to a lot of issues. I would be very surprised if views on immigration and refugees in particular were identical between marginal, not practicing evangelical Christians and those who are highly active in churches. I would expect quite a bit of difference there. I would expect a difference on issues related to abortion. Once again, these are questions that journalists need to ask. Back to the Easter thing, your original point at the start of this conversation was, to what degree can you call someone a Christian if they don't believe in the resurrection? Well, when you look at the liturgical calendar that's come to us through the millennia, Easter is it. I mean, America might sell a lot more goods at the shopping mall at Christmas, but when you look at the heart of Christianity as it's reflected in the liturgical calendars of ancient churches, there is nothing that comes near Easter. So I think that's a perfectly valid question to be asking Christian leaders and Christian followers now and on. It's why it's the number one question in that set of the three questions that I call the TMAT trio, which is when I'm interviewing Christian leaders and trying to find fault lines inside of them, other than political or cultural fault lines, there are three doctrinal questions I ask. And number one is the resurrection real? Did this event really happen? I'm convinced it's a valid question.
One more question for you to kind of pick up off that culture's upstream of politics. Many believe that Europe is upstream of the U.S., that is, that the U.S. follows, as you said, with about a decade or so of lag time.
Yeah.
The trends that are current in Europe or Great Britain, kind of Western Europe. If that's the case, and let's accept that it is for the moment, how does a reporter pursue that question when it comes to stories like we had from the BBC?
Well, let me give you a highly practical example. One of the big stories in Roman Catholicism right now, and justifiably so, is the clergy crisis, whether or not they're going to have enough young priests to be able to carry on with life in the Roman Catholic Church as we've known it. The clergy crisis is directly linked to an issue of Catholic doctrine and demographics in terms of family size, in terms of how many children people have. I've done a lot of writing about this, but a Roman Catholic family with one or two children is much less likely to produce a priest or a nun than a family with four, five, or six children. I think that would be rather obvious. And that's exactly what's happened in the demographics the last 50 years or so, or post-Vatican II or whatever, post-birth control pill or whatever. This is obviously a case where doctrine affects the practice of life, which ends up affecting the church in a very practical way. I would argue that there are similar issues that are affecting the future of evangelical and mainline Protestantism right now. A big one for me right now among evangelical pastors would be to ask some very pointed questions about cohabitation and the impact that they believe cohabitation is having on marriage and family size and children and divorce, etc., in their parishes, and how that's affecting their ability to speak out on these issues. You can make a jump from what people believe to what they do, and then how that affects the church and how that affects the society very easily, if you know how to do it and you want to do it and you think those questions matter. And I argue that they do matter, and that journalists who want to figure out what's upstream of culture, these are exactly the questions they need to be asking.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
Terry's also going to be speaking at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. That's the premier conference for the laity. He's going to be making the case for news discernment, along with him, Pastor Matt Harrison, Aaron Wolf, and let's see, Pastor Todd Peppercorn, Pastor Chris Roseborough, and Pastor Peter Bender, all the presenters at the first Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference for 2017. There'll be another one in November. You can find out about that and register for either conference at our website, issuesetc.org, or call 618-223-8385. The Summer Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference is Friday, June the 9th, and Saturday, June the 10th, in Collinsville, Illinois. You can meet and talk to Terry Mattingly right there. When we come back, we're going to be spending some time in our series, Christ in the Old Testament, picking up where we left off with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer in the book of Hosea, picking up at chapter 4, 5, and 6 of that Old Testament prophet, finding Christ there. Stay tuned.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
There's a dangerous movement in evangelicalism known as the New Apostolic Reformation, and they literally claim that in the past few decades, God has restored apostles and prophets to the church.
Chris Roseborough talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
In my presentation, I'll be making the case against modern-day apostles and prophets. As part of the presentation, we'll be talking about who's teaching this ecclesiology, the inherent dangers of it, but also what's at the root of it, and that is a false understanding of the baptism of the Holy Spirit.
You can meet and hear Chris Roseborough making the case against modern-day prophets and apostles Friday, June 9th and Saturday, June 10th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.